Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause and keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. So tonight I want to talk on a topic, second teaching that the Buddha ever offered on anatta or not self. I rarely speak on this topic, which I'm a little bit disappointed in, just because it can tend to become philosophical, intellectual, or conceptual in nature, and it was never intended to be any of those things. But rather, the teaching on not-self is intended as an exploration, an investigation through mindfulness of the ways in which the mind constructs or creates a sense of self that causes a lot of suffering for us. Have you ever noticed that the ways that you think about yourself cause you suffering? So in the simple form, that's what the Buddha's talking about here. We have to be careful about the ways that we let our mind think about who we are, because the mind will create stories, it will compare, it will judge, it will criticize, all of these things. So I'm going to talk for a bit on this topic of anatta, and I want you to reflect. If you have questions or thoughts or comments, just save them till the end, because I'll get off track. I'll get into my conceptual, intellectual mind. But I just want you to reflect for yourself what resonates with you in your own experience, and to practice, just as important, letting go of what doesn't. What's confusing, what you don't understand, what doesn't make sense, it doesn't matter. That's a hard practice. Because I think in the Western world, we're taught to know about things. But in Buddhism, it doesn't matter what you know about. It matters what you know directly through your present experience. What you can know deep within yourself. That kind of knowing. Kind of like how you know someone. Or you know a place that you've been to. Sure, you can talk about someone or point to a location on a map of somewhere you've been, but you know these things intimately. So that's the encouragement. So I've deliberated. There are two ways to give this talk on anatta. It's like getting into a pool. You can either get in slowly through the steps, or you can jump in the deep end. There's the only two ways you can do it. And there are benefits, and there are conflicts with either way. So I'm going to jump in the deep end. Because I kind of want to just get this part over with. Even though it's so important, it's not that important. So the first thing I want to do is I want to ask you guys, you all, a question. And I want you to answer with whatever comes to mind. So you can just say it out loud. And literally everything you say is wrong. All right? But I still want you to say it. It's right and it's wrong. We'll talk about that. But I want to ask you a question. And I really want to just hear what first comes to mind. Anything that comes to mind. I want to ask you a question. Who are you? Say what?
A person.
A person. Great. Who are you?
I don't know.
Say what?
A husband's version.
Your husband's version? Sometimes. Who are you?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Everybody?
Me?
Me?
A sum of all my parts. Ooh, these are nice. Y'all are giving the talk for me.
An explorer.
Musician.
Confused.
Awesome. Yeah, all these things, right? From a Buddhist perspective, jumping in the deep end here, who you are is not a thing, it's a thought. To put very simply, who you are is not a person as a noun, but rather your whatever current perception of yourself you have. There's a neuropsychologist named Chris Niebauer, the author of this book, No Self, No Problem, says that our sense of self is actually an illusion created by the left side of our brain. This is what he says in the book. The left brain is an interpreter and a story maker. Pattern recognition, language, map making, categorization are all located in the left brain. And the evidence suggests that it is exactly these types of functions that collectively lead to the sensation of a self and the strong belief in its absolute truth. So I'll just read this first part again because I think it's important. Who you are is not a thing, it's a thought. It's actually a construction of the left brain, who's an interpreter and a story maker, responsible for pattern recognition, language, map making, and categorization. It's the brain's job to store memory, to recognize patterns, to create labels, and to make meaning out of our experiences. It's the automatic function of the mind. That means that that's just what the mind does. If you have a brain, it does that. There's a really great Buddhist scholar named Houston Smith, and he says, the brain breathes mind like the lungs breathe air. The brain breathes mind. It constructs, categorizes, makes meaning, and perceives who we are, in quotes, right? So the Buddha's not saying, this is very important, that the teaching of not self is not that you don't have a self. Wait, that's like eight negatives. The Buddha is not saying that you don't have a self. And you have to actually use the double negative here because it's exactly what I said. The Buddha's not saying that you don't have a self. You definitely have a self. But who you are is kind of like a constellation of stars in the sky, right? You look up at a constellation. If you're taught what a ladle is, you see the Big Dipper, right? You can't not see it if you've seen it before, in a way, right? But what is the Big Dipper? It's a constellation of stars. It's made up of parts, right? As Jennifer said. So who we are is a sum of parts. But these parts aren't nouns. They're not things. They're processes. The Buddha is saying that your sense of self is constructed through five mind-body processes. I wrote them up on the board. Remember, we're still in the deep end. So if this is like, whoa, this is crazy, that's all right. Because we're going to walk our way out and hopefully it will get... we'll get into the good stuff. So the Buddha's saying that, just like a constellation is comprised of stars, our sense of self is created or constructed through five mind-body processes. The first one I've translated as body. It's not the best translation. The word is in Pali Sanskrit, it's rupa, and it actually means form. But when you say the word form, I don't know what the hell you mean. And what the Buddha's talking about here in form is he's basically saying that this is, and I wrote up on the board a word that's not actually a word, the sensor or the sense collector. So you have this thing, let's call it body, And the body has all of these domains of sensory input. The five we learned in kindergarten, seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, feeling, right? The body has all of those things. And the body also has and comprises within it this amazing machine we call the mind. And the mind, in the Buddhist, from the Buddhist perspective, is also a sense. Have you ever noticed, I like to say, that you're sensitive to your mind? You ever have a thought and it affects how you feel? So there are six senses in Buddhism. Let's keep it real simple. And there's this thing, we call it form or body, that collects the senses. It's all housed in this form. Seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, feeling, thinking. The sensor. So one process that you are is the sensor. The sensor collects the data, and then the feeler uses perception to feel the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral qualities of the sensory experience. So just right now in this moment, very simple, how does it feel? My leg's asleep, unpleasant. Overall, my mental attitude or state is pretty neutral. So those are the feeling tones of my present experience. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? Very simple. So you see, the Buddha didn't really complicate things. So far, he says you have a body and it has senses, and those senses impact how you feel. Make sense so far? Then we also have this aspect of the mind that Chris Niebauer is calling the interpreter. The interpreter, the perceiver, is the one that labels, categorizes, and makes meaning out of the sensory experience. This also happens automatically. We know this is a bell. If you have the ability to hear, you know that's the sound of the bell. You don't have to think about that. Your mind perceives there's sound, the perception, bell. Don't think it, you just know it. And there's also a feeling tone. Is that pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? I perceive it as pleasant because I associate it with meditation. Right? If you're one of Pavlov's dogs and you heard the bell, you may start salivating and get hungry. You may have an unpleasant association, or a pleasant association but unpleasant until it's rewarded, right? So we have, very simple, a body that collects sensory information. We feel it. At the same time, we feel it, we perceive it. So those happen all at the same time. And then we have one of the most important parts, mental formation. This is the storyteller. So then we start to think about some of these experiences. This is cognition. Cognition just means thinking. This is volition, which is what I call the to-do mind, doing something about what you're processing, feeling, perceiving. And then there's the enactment, which is the acting upon what you're perceiving, feeling, sensing. All right? So y'all follow so far? It's a lot of information, but it's actually really simple, hopefully. And then, to keep things really simple, we have consciousness. Consciousness is just the awareness. If you were sedated right now, you would not have some of the sensory information, some of the feeling tones, some of the perceptions, and some of the mental formations, right? You would be maybe dreaming, maybe other states of consciousness, other ways of being aware, which we're not going to get into. But basically, there's this awareness, this way that you're knowing what you're experiencing. All right, so we have a body, a sensory domain that experiences sensation. It affects how we feel. We make sense out of it. And then we create stories, and we act upon how we think about the experience. And we're aware when it's happening, and sometimes we're not aware. So this is the deep end of the pool. The Buddha says, this is what you are. And there's practices around this. In Zen Buddhism, you sit, face a wall, and ask the question repeatedly, who is this? Who is this? Whatever comes up, this thought, are you your mind? I'd be pretty embarrassed if I was my mind. I'd be very humbled if I was my mind. I'm humbled just that I have an experience of mind. Right? Am I the feelings that I'm experiencing, the sensations? Where am I in all of this? Can you find me? So this isn't philosophical. It's actually a liberating teaching. It's a teaching that helps you to find freedom from suffering. And we'll talk about how here in a moment. So what I want to say here is I want to just pause before we talk about why we're talking about this and say that through mindfulness, through careful attention, we start to use our awareness, our consciousness in a way, to tune into these processes, to start to deconstruct a complex experience into rudimentary parts. This is what's called Vipassana or insight meditation. If you've ever wondered, you know, where mindfulness comes from, it comes from this tradition of Vipassana, which is insight meditation. Insight means to see clearly into the nature of things. So what is the nature of mind? It's to think. The body senses, feels, perceives. Right? And so there's not a self to be found in this process. There's just this process. So how is this liberating? So we're going to get to the good part. The Buddha says, in this fathom-long body, with its thoughts and perceptions, lies the world, the origin of the world, and the ceasing of the world. In this fathom-long body, with its thoughts and perceptions, lies the world, the origin of the world, and the ceasing of the world. We construct who we are through our thoughts and perceptions. Our world is created through our thoughts and perceptions. Who you are, how you're doing, how good or bad you're doing, if you're where you should be in life, how you measure up, how successful you are, all of these things are constructed through our thoughts and perceptions. I want to read a quote by Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's a Buddhist scholar as well, and he talks about the power of our thoughts and perceptions. He says, our thoughts govern our attitudes, our actions, and our whole orientation to the world we live in. Our thoughts might not be clearly formulated in our mind. We might have only a hazy conceptual grasp of them. But whether formulated or not, expressed or maintained in silence, these thoughts have a far-reaching influence. Your thoughts structure your perceptions, order your values, and crystallize into the framework through which you interpret to yourself your meaning of being in this world. The mind is incredibly powerful. And in particular, this part of the mind that we're going to call the interpreter and the storyteller. Number 3 and 4 up there. How do we interpret, and what are the stories we tell about ourselves, and as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, our meaning of being in the world? So there are a few reasons why we want to look at what I call selfing. Let's say selfing is just a habit your mind has to create a story of yourself. Some of these stories of ourselves were really great, some of them were just okay, and some of them were a piece of shit. One of the problems with selfing is that oftentimes you interpret how good or bad you're doing based upon how good or bad you're feeling. Right? And this happens more often than I think we care to recognize. We often interpret how good or bad we're doing, this story of me, based upon how good or bad we're feeling. And a really simple way to look at this is one of the things I learned in early recovery is they talk about HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Right? So I have to be careful on how I assess how I'm doing or how, you know, attractive I am or how any story of myself. There's so many of them, right? I have to really watch this part of my mind that creates stories of who I am when I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You know, I was driving into work like a couple months ago. I tell this actually at the place that I work at. And I turned onto this rural road. It takes about 15 minutes to drive down this road. And I was totally consumed in this just inner negativity. I was just picking apart my life and my job and all of this stuff. And I turn into the place where I work. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this moment of mindfulness came to me. And I recognized I was just totally tripping because I felt like shit. I was exhausted. I was tired. I was hungry. I was just, for whatever reason, in an unpleasant mood. You know, and so even our moods are our most deceiving things, I think, a lot of the time. Because the mood is like a weather system. You can't see your way out of it. It's just, it covers everything. And so when we create or construct a sense of how we're doing based upon a mood, you see what I'm saying? Like, there's a lot of suffering in that. If all I did for the next, like, 2 years of my meditation practice is just look at the mood that I'm in and have awareness of it and try to watch out attaching myself to it, there would be a lot of reduction in suffering for me. So one of the reasons we want to look out for the mind selfing, its tendency to tell you who you are and how you're doing, is because we tend to interpret that based upon how good or bad we're feeling. All right, so another reason, this is again a little bit more into the deep end, but then we're just taking a step back, is that we perceive our present experiences based upon past experiences. So in a way, this is really simple. Right? Everything you know today is a culmination of everything you've known already. It's very, really simple. It's not even philosophy, it's just practical. So if you go into a new situation, I like to put it really simple, right? You'll notice most of your old beliefs coming out in situations that are unfamiliar to you, right? You'll start looking around and trying to figure out who's safe and who can you talk to and, you know, what's going to happen. And we get into using our old map to explore new territory a lot of the time. You know what I mean? So the important thing here is that we know that we have an old map. And the old map doesn't always see things completely. And I don't say that it doesn't see them accurately, because your map sees a lot of shit pretty accurately, but it never sees everything completely. Does that make sense? It only sees it based upon your one limited lifetime of experience. So there are some psychology theories. This is where I just take a step back for a second, because I find it interesting. And people have studied this. It's called object relations theory. And a really simple way to put this is that our memory system, which they call your internal working model, the way that you perceive the world, is largely formed through early childhood attachment, through family dynamics, and through early childhood and adolescent experiences, things that you have been through. All right, so attachment, family dynamics, early childhood and adolescent experiences, and then other experiences that pile on top. So these formative experiences, this is stepping back into the shallow end, these formative experiences can shape our attitudes about our self-worth. All right, so now we're getting into where can selfing cause a problem? In the ways that we perceive our self-worth, which is nothing more than a perception that was formed from an experience or over time through experiences. So who your sense of self is literally a perception that was shaped through experiences and over time. So sometimes in psychology, they call these like your core beliefs. But this is a little tricky because perception goes beyond a explicit thought, it goes into what they call implicit memory, which is what a guy, forget his name, Canadian psychologist, calls feeling beliefs. So not only do you think, and you may never think I'm worthless as an actual thought in your mind, but it's a feeling belief that pervades your perception. Right? It's like you have a bunch of lenses that you view the world through, and one of your lenses has a tint to it, and you can't really see the tint because you're looking through the lens, you know? And this tint is, I'm worthless. Or I'll read a bunch of them. There's something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. I'm incompetent. I'm inadequate. I'm unlovable. I'm stupid. I'm ugly. I'm a disappointment. I'm disgusting. I'm different. I'm invisible. I'm a failure. These are all feeling beliefs. Remember, they're not explicit necessarily. They're feeling beliefs of defectiveness and shame. So that's just the defectiveness and shame category. And then there are other feeling beliefs that come through experiences. Experiences of, for lack of better terms, we'll just say family dynamics or experiences where we fell into the dynamic of caretaking or feeling guilty or responsible. It's my fault. What did I do wrong? I should have done something different. I should have known better. I should not have blank. Then there are feeling beliefs about safety. I'm going to die. I'm in danger. It's not okay to be safe. I'm not safe. About control and choices. I'm out of control. I'm powerless. I'm helpless. I'm weak. I can't protect myself. I can't trust my judgment. I cannot get what I want. I have to be perfect. So the emotion that usually arises out of this last category, the control and choices, I'm out of control, I'm powerless, I'm helpless, is anger. So that's a good indicator that you might experience this, or perfectionism that causes anger, frustration. All right, so just to get back to the simple form, one of the reasons why we want to look at the selfing is to just understand that how you view the world is based upon a map of experiences you've had. And it's not right or wrong or good or bad, it's just how it is. That's how this brain, this mind works. All right, and then the last category, one that I think is the most relatable, is what Brené Brown calls the self-made stories. The self-made stories, these are our inner dialogues with ourselves. Right? These are the lavish stories that we construct, or that the mind constructs. Here's what Brené Brown has to say. She says, of no fault of our own, the mind often attempts to keep us safe by becoming overly concerned with our status and about what people think, about always being better than and always being right. I think of this part of my mind as my inner hustler. It's always telling me to compare, prove, please, perfect, outperform, and compete. The inner hustler has a shame-based fear of being ordinary. The hustler has very little tolerance for discomfort and self-reflection, which is a willingness to challenge our self-made stories. Without active awareness, mindfulness, the mind doesn't take responsibility for the stories, nor does it have any interest in writing new endings to them. If unattended, the mind will quickly use its stories as armor and alibi. Avoiding truth and vulnerability are critical parts of the hustle.
Nailed it.
Why is Brené Brown so popular? That's an interesting question. What does she research?
Shame.
I think it's a Western epidemic. It's something that we have unlike any other culture globally. Sure, they have it in other cultures, but it is very unique in our culture. There's a famous story of a lot of the American Buddhist teachers that studied in Southeast Asia in the 60s and 70s, a lot of them bringing this lineage to North America, visiting with the Dalai Lama one time. And the Dalai Lama held a question and answer portion, and one of the teachers raised her hand and asked, "What do you do with people that have so much shame and self-hatred?" And the Dalai Lama listened to his translator and had a confused look on his face, and he went back to the translator and spoke in Tibetan, and the translator spoke back to him, and they went on for like a couple minutes. And then he finally, it's like he understood, and he looked and he said, "No," he said, "that's wrong." He said, "Why do you hate yourself?" He didn't even have a language to describe that experience. You know, and so not only, I mean, to get deep end and shallow end, not only is there not a self in that sense, but this self that we construct is often one that is shameful. So thinking about yourself isn't a problem. We all need a sense of self. You know what I mean? That's healthy. Self-esteem, you know, a sense of self-worth, that's healthy. But how you think about yourself is really where the Buddha's pointing. How you think about yourself. One of the other things I think is an epidemic is this idea of self-improvement. You know, as if there is something to improve. Buddhism is much more, it's a path of self-acceptance, not self-improvement. There's nothing wrong with you. You know, there's nothing wrong with you. Sure, we can improve our experience. We can try to practice principles and be more intentional and more aware, but there's nothing wrong with yourself. You know what I mean? Now, this is a little bit of a koan, kind of crazy, but it's by Alan Watts, and I love it. I found it earlier, and I it's like I remembered it, and I actually tripped out for a second. He said, the reason, this is kind of about self-improvement, in the myth of self-improvement in a way, that there's nothing wrong with you. He says, the reason you want to be better is the reason why you aren't. Do you still think you can be happy by trying to be happy? Now, it sounds like we can look at that one way and say, oh, that's just some spiritual mumbo-jumbo. But I think what he's saying here is that the reason why we're not happy is because we think that we need to be someone better to be happy. You know what I'm saying? And so it's the once I become the person I need to be, then I'll be happy. And we never get to that fucking person. You see what I'm saying? It's like, what if I could, to practice some of what Brené Brown talks about, practice this authenticity and vulnerability and realize that everyone is in this human experience and it's fucking wild. And there's nothing wrong with you. If you're struggling, if you're suffering, if you even want to die. You know, people come to me all the time as a therapist and it's like them telling me that they have thoughts of killing themselves is going to shock me or something. It's like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And it's maybe sounds wild to say, but it's not that wild. Like, you know, maybe you don't. Or to not exist as we do, right? Maybe we don't go to the thought, I wouldn't even say it's an extreme, of wanting to die, but of not wanting to exist as we do right now, however we are. This is what the Buddha calls craving for non-existence. Not wanting to be. So how do we work with the self? Let's just talk about simply. So we can start to look at the aggregates, which are up on the board. These are called the five aggregates. We can start to look at especially three of them. Feeling, and how feeling is oftentimes an indicator of how we interpret things. And so we can start to look at if it's a pleasant feeling, we may feel good about ourselves in our life. If we're feeling unpleasant, we may have that tint of negativity, right? Or the, as they say in AA, morbid self-reflection. Right? Because we don't feel good. You see it all the time with people in detox and substance treatment. And, you know, week into detox, they're like, this isn't working. I'm like, dude, you have been shooting heroin for a decade, and you feel like shit right now. You should not be allowed to talk for a couple weeks, you know? Like, they should strap you to a bed and feed you good food and sing you songs and try to cheer you up, but you're not allowed to go anywhere or think anything for 2 weeks. You know, so we can start to look at feeling and how feeling affects how we think about ourselves. We can start to look at perception, and we can do that in a simple way, just by understanding our story. You know, and giving ourselves some validation. It's like, oh yeah, of course I feel like I don't belong in this group, in this room when I walk in, because that's been a lot of my experience in my formative years, is feeling disconnected and like I don't belong. That's an old feeling belief. I mean, it's like good friend of mine now. You know, and then we can start to look at these stories that we construct that Brené Brown calls these self-made stories. When we actually start to participate, you know what I mean? Some of these are like the kind of victim or the, you know, just different stories that we kind of get caught up in. The comparing mind, she calls it the inner hustler. Compete, prove, predict, outperform, those thoughts. And so the way we do this is mindfulness. A really great practice is just learning how to be with the feeling and practicing sometimes dropping the story. Telling the mind in a moment where things are hard for you, hey mind, give me a few minutes. And you're going to have to remind your mind like all the time. I'm not going to go there right now with you. I'm just going to see if I can be with this loneliness or this fear, this sadness, and be there for it with compassion. I feel you. I care for you. It's so crazy because it's like the last thing I ever want to do is just sit and be compassionate to what I'm feeling. I think that the Buddha's going to give me the right answer, and if I learn the right list or the right theory or whatever it is, that I can somehow shortcut my difficulty. I can bypass it. But it's right there and meeting it with compassion. Can I be with it? Of course I don't want to be with it. That's always the second thing that people say. I'll be sitting with someone like, okay, feeling lonely, how is that? It sucks. Yeah, I know it sucks, but how is it? Well, it's just kind of like pit feeling in my stomach, and it's a fear and a sadness. It's like, okay, yeah, where do you find that in your body? Can you go to it? Well, that sucks. Yeah, I know it sucks, but can you? Can you go to it? Because if I don't, who is, right? I'll look for all sorts of ways to try to cope with it. Scroll on my phone, smoke a cigarette, you know, drink a drink, eat a food, take a drug, you know, distract, whatever it is. Those things in and of themselves, fine, whatever. But how do we learn to open to what's painful and difficult? You know, so this practice has changed my life, because what it's given me is awareness. It's given me awareness. And awareness, I always say, is not always good news, but it's good information. You know, and it's like the Buddhist Bible salesman, have you heard the bad news? That's the have you heard the bad news? This is a feeling and it's here. This is a thought, And it's here. You know, notice the thought. Okay, be with the feeling. All right, that's it. Right? It's simple, but it's hard. And we can do it, and we can practice. And so if mindfulness isn't the, if meditation isn't the escape that you thought it is, good. You know, if you sit down and you notice your mind is a neurotic mess, yeah, okay, good. Because now you're seeing the nature of your mind. You know what I mean? And that's the mind you live with when you're not sitting quietly. It's the one that I'm running from and running around with and getting caught up in. So, good, I can get to know it. Someone, one of Joseph Goldstein's teachers, said that the job of the yogi or the meditator is to make a friendly companion of your mind.